Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome back to SpondyCast. Our guest today is Dr. Naimish Bakshi. He focuses his expertise on the subspecialty of sports medicine, spine care, pain management, and musculoskeletal medicine. He received his medical degree from New Jersey Medical School, formerly an institute of the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, and now part of Rutgers School of Biomedical Health Sciences. He completed an internship at the Jersey Medical Center under the Barnabas Health System and his residency in physical medicine and rehab at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Following his residency, Dr. Bakshi completed an interventional spine and sports medicine fellowship at Orthopedic and Spine Specialist Health in Pennsylvania. He has been published many times in the field of physical medicine and rehab. He is a New Jersey native growing up locally in East Brunswick, and he and his wife currently reside in Montvale. He is fluent in Spanish and Gujarati. In his spare time, he remains dedicated to wellness and staying physically active. And he has a passion for exercise and nutrition, along with following a paleo diet and being an avid CrossFitter. Dr. Bakshi, thank you so much for joining us to talk about regenerative medicine and musculoskeletal health today. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored that I'm part of this, and hopefully I can provide insight for your listeners on on the role of some regenerative therapies excited to talk.
Great. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background, especially in spine and musculoskeletal?
Sure. Yeah. So I never know where to start with this kind of question, but I went to medical school really not knowing what I wanted to do, other than, you know, sort of the blanket, I want to help people kind of mission. I discovered physiatry or physical medicine and rehabilitation. It's a small field. One that was historically important in the role of rehabbing, you know, people after they came home from Korean War, World War II, and they had a lot of, you know, irreversible musculoskeletal injuries, things like amputations or traumatic brain injuries. And you know, our field evolved into sort of helping people generally with any orthopedics or musculoskeletal issue. There's different arms of physiatry, but the path that I pursued was really non-surgical management of orthopedic conditions. I did a fellowship in sports medicine and interventional pain management, really learning the technical skills involved in a lot of pain management interventions for spine related issues. So I see kind of everything. I see head to toe issues. I see people with neck pain and back pain and hip and shoulder. I work alongside my orthopedics surgery and rheumatology colleagues at the Hospital for Special Surgery, which is this amazing institution, which really is a unique place because we are probably the only place in the country that really just focuses on musculoskeletal care. So I hope that answers the question. I'm not sure. I just said a lot of things.
No, that's fantastic. And I think I recall we had, and her name escapes me, from HSS, one of the yoga practitioners, on who was just fascinating. So we're familiar with Hospital for Special Surgery. So, and for people who might not be familiar, What is regenerative medicine compared to a traditional approach?
Yeah, I don't love the name, but regenerative medicine arose from the idea that we can use cells, that we can either get from our own body or from somewhere else to help, in theory, regenerate damaged tissue. So, you know, I think in the musculoskeletal world, you have one of the most common afflictions, osteoarthritis, where you have loss of cartilage or wearing away of cartilage. And so, you know, using these quote unquote cell-based or regenerative therapies to help create new cartilage, I think is the premise of regenerative medicine. By the way, that doesn't happen, and we can dive into that more, but that's kind of where the name comes from, helping create or change damaged tissue into better sort of more native tissue.
And so for spine and joint, or somebody with spondylitis or spondyloarthritis, which is interesting because I didn't know it was, it started with osteo. Sorry, I digress. But is plasma, like plasma injections is another form of it? Is that something, can you talk a little bit more about?
Yeah. I'm not sure if it started with osteoarthritis. I just mean that I think the premise was to create new tissue or heal damaged tissue.
Okay.
In terms of regenerative treatments, there's like only a few types, right? There's platelet rich plasma or a concentrated solution of platelets. Platelets are these powerful cells that we have that initiate the healing response in any acute injury. So we know, for example, for like wound healing, right? If you get a cut, you start to bleed. The first thing that happens is platelets come to the area to help stop the bleeding. And in platelets, you have multiple types of cells. One of them is like this, is fibrin that is adhesive. So kind of platelets are able to stick to the void. And then they release a bunch of other cells called growth factors and cytokines that are involved in recruiting things like stem cells to help rebuild new skin. So after we have a cut, as long as it's not like super deep, right? 2-3 weeks later, usually it looks like nothing happened because scar forms, stem cells come in. Something called platelets will recruit endothelial growth factors, and new skin is rebuilt. And, you know, maybe there's a scar, but really skin heals really well and rebuilds, right? It's frankly, I mean, when we think about it, it's pretty amazing. And so historically we've used platelets in the world of wound healing, right? These sort of deep pressure ulcers, people that have, in the dental world, yeah, same thing, like ulcers around the gums. So yeah. We know that platelets are involved in wound healing and tissue healing. And we know that sort of the exogenous injection of one's own platelets into these wounds can help facilitate tissue repair. So that over the last few decades, probably three decades really, and even in the last few years, it's evolved. In orthopedic conditions, we know that things like tendinopathy, where we have tendon injury and we have poor healing because of like a chronic overuse. I think of like tennis elbow, for instance, where the lateral epicondyle tendons, the muscles of the wrist extensors, those muscles become tendon attaches to bone. tendon tears, it doesn't heal well, you re-injure it, it tears, it doesn't heal well, and you go through this cycle of injury, poor healing. And we've biopsied those tendons and found some inflammatory cells, which is important, right, in the world of any autoimmune condition, but especially spondyloarthropathy, where there's some inflammation, but there's much more scar tissue than there is inflammation. And so by injecting platelets directly into the tendon, for instance, it sort of creates almost an acute injury, which then allows for the better, for a more optimal healing cascade to occur rather than more scar tissue to develop. So I think in terms of regeneration, platelets can help indirectly induce the creation of healthier tissue by recruiting cells involved in tissue repair.
Interesting. So, and if I can repeat this part of this back, once there's a lot of scar tissue, it's more difficult for there to be the healing that goes on. And sometimes that's why the intervention is useful.
Absolutely. The scar tissue is the healing, but it's suboptimal healing, right?
Right.
Most cases. And so once there's scar tissue, your body's like, all right, we did the best we could.
Right. You
know? And so it's not really that particular structure area, especially tendons, ligaments, they're not getting the resources needed to reverse that pathology or to create new, better, healthier tissue.
Interesting. So platelet PRP or platelet rich plasma injections, do they always go hand in hand with stem cell therapies?
I think that there's a relationship in that when we utilize platelets for some sort of tissue healing or tissue repair, stem cells are part of that physiologic mechanism of action. And they're often in the same sort of conversation as quote unquote stem cells. The reason I say that is because the reality is when we're talking about stem cells, it's not always purely stem cells that are being utilized.
Right.
But yes, I think in the same conversation, we'll talk about stem cells and platelets as like regenerative cell-based biologic treatment.
Would you pick one or the other, or for a different condition? Like, are there certain, and you touched a bit on how stem cells work, but I walk to your office with a complaint, how is there a specific way you decide if there was one or the other?
It depends. Depends on a lot of things. the mechanism of stem cells. So let's back up for a second. Stem cells are these progenitor cells that we have a bank of, right? That haven't differentiated into like a particular cell or a family of cells. And we've banked them in a few areas, mostly our bone marrow and our adipose. Stem cells also exist in like placental tissue and umbilical cord tissue. Stem cells haven't really decided what they're going to be or what they're going to do. And what stem cells end up doing once they're in a particular environment, and so they're influenced by their surrounding, they can become some type of other cell, or they can kind of serve as like a signaling molecule to contribute somehow to that particular environment that cell is now living in. As it relates to like musculoskeletal conditions, the mechanism of how they work, if they work, frankly, is still like very unclear. I think that's what the ongoing research is really dedicated to, is understanding the mechanism, understanding on a very basic level, like, do they work, just clinical outcomes, and like everything in between, right? The how and the why. So back to your question about, like, if you came to my office with a particular complaint, would I like pick PRP or stem cells or you know, or some other type of therapy? I mean, it depends, because it's hard to decide what intervention to do when we don't necessarily have clear data as to which one is helpful. And to even like to decide, let's just say we decide that you have some condition that's going to benefit from some cell-based regenerative option. You know, as an evidence-based clinician, right, if I don't have a study that compares PRP directly to, let's say, adipose-derived stem cell injections for a particular condition, it would be hard for me to say that one is better than the other, or either of them are useful for that particular condition, you know? Okay. So people that are like, yeah, you know, you should really do stem cell injections for rotator cuff injury instead of PRP, it's way better. I mean, like, there's no one has compared that, to my knowledge, head to head in a meaningful way to have that conclusion. You know, okay, when you think about like bigger drug trials, it's like, what's the gold standard? Well, comparing interventions or medications or some sort of treatment to a placebo and having a control group, right? And so yeah. I think we're all working on that in the research world, in this field, but there's a lot more to, I think, understand and before we can drive clinical decision making, we need to kind of have these kind of outcome studies.
Okay. And if we're not talking, if we're talking about generally regenerative therapies, are they most effective in specific joints overall, or?
Yeah. I think.
Tell like me. People with SPA, is always our big question mark here.
So I think, yes, I think the biggest, there is a lot of literature that's been published about the use of platelets in chronic tendinopathies. Probably, you know, knee osteoarthritis is the most common joint affected by osteoarthritis. And so there's a lot of data to both support and refute the use of platelets and stem cells for knee arthritis. There's very little published on the use of platelet injections or stem cell injections in spondylitis. I mean, there's one small study using PRP, which is platelet-rich plasma. Essentially, that's just a concentrated solution of your own platelets. I think there's a small study addressing the question of whether PRP is better than cortisone for sacroiliitis. Small study, I think the N was less than 20, you know, so it's hard to really kind of utilize a study like that in terms of making like a general conclusion about the utility of platelets. Yeah. I think there's some work being done. There's a lot of work being done, of course, in like stem cell transplantation. Right now, really, like stem cell transplantation is really used for like blood cancers. But there's certainly a use case in autoimmune conditions and even things like multiple sclerosis. There's some newer studies showing some promising results and clinical improvement, but I think there's a lot in still like the research phase.
Yeah. It sounds like there's a huge opportunity to research spondyloarthritis and regenerative therapies. That would be a hint.
I'm with you. And I think the mechanism is somewhat different, right? The mechanism is different because there's, an autoimmune condition versus an osteoarthritic condition. But there's still this overlap of inflammation that, that causes pain and dysfunction and functional impairment. And there's certainly, in theory, a use for both platelets and stem cells in mitigating an inflammatory response. So yes, I think there's a real opportunity to study both types of cells as it relates to autoimmune conditions.
So patient wise or success story wise, what do you hear from people in terms of positive outcomes?
Yeah, when I utilize things like platelets or adipose or bone marrow derived stem cells, we're typically using them for like tendons, ligaments, joints. Some people use them in the spine. I think the literature is really plus or minus, and a lot more to come in that world, like intradiscal biologics. There's a group of people that do really well. I think we're still trying to understand the phenotype that does well, whether it's age or male, female, or like mechanism of injury, chronicity of injury. So I think that part is really tough, right? Picking the right person that's going to respond the best. But in my personal experience, the best responders to something like PRP for a tendon or joint issue are the ones that don't have severe pathology, right? The ones that are sort of mild, moderate arthritis or mild, moderate tendinopathy. And the ones that are relatively like active, right? So I think motion is lotion for some cases, right? Where, just kind of injecting this therapy and then making sure someone is still motivated to kind of move and rehab and that all that increases blood flow and can stimulate healing. So I've had really good success with, like chronic tendinopathies affecting the knee, the elbow, the shoulder, and mild to moderate arthritic joints, knee, hip, shoulder, and even smaller joints like ankle. People with like post-traumatic arthritis in the ankle or small joints like the CMC or the wrist. So there's a myriad of things that we'll use it for. But the, kind of understanding who's going to be the best responder, I think is still somewhat challenging.
Interesting. Okay. So, someone were to consider, right, there's a lot of well-researched therapies. To your point, this is one that deserves more research. But there's this rise of like the med spa. So if you're a patient with a chronic condition, who would you rely on as your guide to talk to you about getting regenerative therapies? I saw on LinkedIn last week, like somebody I know, they're like, oh, I spent the week in the hyperbaric chamber and I got my platelets reshuffled and new stem cells. Without a lot of the evidence, like who do we lean on for whether or not we're a good candidate for a stem cell therapy or a regenerative therapy?
Yeah, it's so challenging for I imagine your listeners and you know, people like you that have this condition, because you are trying to find a treatment that's just going to help your symptoms. And it's tough when non-steroidals aren't really helping, and the DMARDs aren't really doing a whole lot, and then you're on multiple medications and you're trying to rehab, but it hurts to like move. And so, you know, I think the worst position to be in as a patient is being vulnerable, right? Is being vulnerable. And when you're vulnerable, you're susceptible to these LinkedIn testimonials and ads showing people, you know, jumping on the beach and swimming in the ocean and talking about stem cell, whatever, right? And these health spas and hyperbaric chamber and, you know, hot cold therapies. It's tough. I mean, look, that's the advantage of, I always tell people this when they come to my office, because it's a tough conversation. Most of these, at least like the cell-based therapies are not covered by insurance, right? We just don't have enough data, nor do we have the knowledge of the how and the why. And so, of course, insurance companies aren't going to be eager to pay for a therapy that isn't necessarily proven in a really like meaningful, strong way, which is good. They shouldn't, right? That the onus is on the researchers to prove that a particular therapy works, and then the payer should come around. So when you're dealing with this world of like cash-based treatments, people are going to be financially motivated. And so the best type of person to talk to is the one that's not financially motivated. Right. I mean, I think that's my answer to your question, and it's hard to find that person. I mean, it's hard. There's clinics and things that are popping up all over the place, and largely they're businesses. Right. And I also don't want to, I think there's a role for them. I'm not trying to kind of sit on a high horse here and say that I'm the academic, unbiased clinician that, has all the answers, you know, but, I don't know. I rely on evidence-based providers and people that can kind of sift through the evidence and give an honest opinion without having, and just like anything else, right? People that are financially motivated are going to have a bias.
Yeah, and, for sure. Yeah. I mean, and it's hard, right? I can truthfully say, like in 2000, I don't know, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, like I could barely get out of bed. And if somebody would tell me like they could help me, I'd be like, yeah, like let's try that.
Yeah.
And the downside is a lot of it is, it is very expensive. And I'm also someone who's probably a product of feeling better after alternative therapies, more in like the Ayurvedic, but really deeply trying to like fix my own root causes for why I didn't feel good. You gave me a flashback of like, I can remember watching the Humira commercials, and I wanted to be the woman on the Humira commercial building the Habitat for Humanity house. And I walked with a cane and could barely lift a grocery bag. And ironically, now I'm hosting a podcast for SAA that is sponsored by AbbVie. maybe I became the Humira girl, but it's really challenging. So I appreciate your like empathy to that, because, you know, and I always sort of like lean back on my rheumatologist and ask her. And I think a lot of us do, lean back. And I think it's similar, you know, in the pain clinic sense, there are certain things that like we do want to try.
And that's just it, right? Like even though Like you mentioned, like what's the downside of going to some hyperbaric chamber or going to some, you know, weekend spa that specializes in a multidisciplinary approach to, you know, a particular inflammatory condition? The downside is money, of course,
yeah.
but that's it, right? I mean, all of these other, you know, things like acupuncture and Ayurvedic interventions and modalities where, you know, like some form of heat, whether it's, you know, a sauna or shockwave therapy, you know, these are all just different forms of delivering heat, right, to tissue. It's all benign. It's all safe, right? Nothing really bad's going to happen. And so people that are in pain and suffering are, you know, can be sort of influenced in spending money on these treatments that may or may not work, but the downside other than money is very little. So, and also don't get me wrong. Like I'm not here to dismiss those interventions or treatments either. I think that doing, you know, researching these things is tough and complicated and requires a lot of resources and motivation, right? But I don't think that there isn't a role for them. You know, I was asked to comment on this article that looked at a two-arm control, like placebo-controlled study comparing acupuncture versus like a sham acupuncture in people that have like herniated discs, right?
Okay.
And you know, the interviewer was like, well, what do you think of this article? Does this change your management, right? And first of all, one paper is not going to change management unless it's like a monumental study. But you know, second of all, like I think that there's a lot of flaws in the study, and so I talked about the flaws in the study. But at the end, you know, ultimately, like, this was an attempt to show that potentially something like acupuncture can be used as a tool amongst many other tools in helping patients that are suffering from this particular condition, right? So I think that, you know, outside of the medications and some of these cell-based therapies, there's a whole bag of tricks that can maybe help. And for someone like you, that was, you know, and other, you know, people, listeners that are in various stages of this affliction, and obviously things can wax and wane and you can be incapacitated at times. You know, why not try something that could potentially help even 20%, right? 20% better could mean being able to walk from point A to point B without an assistive device.
Yeah. And I think to your point earlier that some of these, we don't fully know the phenotype or the exact person that it's always going to help. Yeah, I'm always for trying things. I am always also to your other point is like I tend toward proceeding with caution at times when there's not, when someone's overly financially motivated. Kind of like trying to get rid of my crow's feet.
Yeah, you never. I mean, I think Kool-Aid drinkers are dangerous, right? Because they're the ones that are genuinely convinced that something works and can really convince others, right? They sort of we've all seen people like that, and it's they're just tough because they're drinking the Kool-Aid and yeah, they probably, you know, there's financial motivations, but there's also people that are just convinced of something, even in the absence of like logic and data.
Yeah.
These cell-based treatments are interesting because there's, you know, there's some people think believe that it can be used indiscriminately. I think it's problematic when, you know, I think it's problematic to use, especially when things are sort of in an active or acute state. And certainly with spondylitis, there's varying states and stages. And I certainly would be very reluctant to use something like PRP in an actively inflamed SI joint, for instance.
Okay.
It can actually, in some ways, provoke or promote inflammation, which in a person that does not have an autoimmune condition is our healing response, right? Is our protective response.
Right.
Someone with spondylitis, it's pathologic inflammation. So the last thing you want to do is invoke even more of an inflammatory response in someone that's like actively inflamed.
That's a really good point that I think we also potentially, as the patient, can forget when you're miserable, like you're looking for what will save the day. And so similar, maybe it's a good example, maybe not, like you get a muscle sprain or strain or non-AS related, you might not want to run right to get a massage until you've got some, I don't know if the right word is stability in that area of your body. That's a really, that's a very good point. So in terms of cost, because we do think that there is, right, there's reasons for this type of treatment, obviously. But in terms of cost, like what is, can you talk a little bit about typical costs and how that looks for people? Or is it a like one shot and, or is it an ongoing treatment?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a hard question. You know, the anytime in medicine, and maybe there's other examples, you know, in different worlds, but in my world, anything that's like cash based, right, that's out of pocket, there's no regulation, right, as to how much things can cost, and it's very regional. It's just like anything else, or supply demand drives cost. A colleague of mine at HSS did a study looking at what, you know, just kind of like a survey. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Market study, basically asking providers across the country that do what we do, asking them, you know, kind of anonymously, like what they charge for PRP for a joint or something like that.
Right.
Standard deviation wasn't that high. It was probably like a couple hundred bucks, and the range was anywhere between like 500 to 2000, but it's very regional.
Right.
You know, if you're on the Upper East Side, your price tag is going to be maybe 2x, you know, kind of like a smaller community in the Midwest or something like that. So,
right.
That's probably the range for a PRP injection is about that much. It's probably like anywhere between $500 to $2,000 if I had to put like a number on it. And I get this asked a lot, like, do I need multiple, you know, injections? I went to a clinic and they told me that I need a series of three. I mean, that's all based on nothing other than people trying to wring more money out of folks, right? Unless someone showed me a study that said three PRP injections 3 months apart is better than one for, you know, condition X. I do one treatment and kind of see how people are 6 weeks later. You know, this is supposed to be like, in theory, like definitive healing. Right. It's supposed to be like a solution in a sense. I guess I don't love that word, but you know, it's supposed to be not a Band-Aid, but a repair. So, I don't subscribe to like the necessity for multiple treatments. I reassess at 6 weeks, 2 months, 3 months. And, you know, if people are much better and they're rehabbing and they're progressing, we kind of just, you know, the majority of my patients that I do PRP on at least only get one treatment and they're good, or they're not good and we have to figure something else out. But in the small percentage of people that are like 40, 50, 60% better, but they're just not quite there yet, all right, I'll do like a second treatment 6 months later. But, you know, I do give it a full 3-6 months of healing, just like how really any sort of tendon or any like orthopedic condition takes to heal, we have to give it the time and dedicated rehab.
That's a good point. And I think it's probably worth restating things we've talked about, which is what advice would you give to people to make informed decisions? Like, and we've kind of hit on, I think, look for a reputable clinic, probably cost evidence of whether or not it looks like it's going to work for the condition that you're treating it for, and not in an active inflammatory state. Is that
kind of? Absolutely. And ask the questions that we're talking about. In the world of stem cells, it's a little bit dangerous, and the FDA is cracking down on this in a very active way. I mentioned the different types of places you can get stem cells from: adipose, bone marrow, placenta, umbilical cord. In America, it is illegal to administer non-autologous or manipulated cells in a human being that is not part of like an FDA approved clinical trial. So like, you go to these stem cell clinics and thank goodness a lot of these are getting shut down finally, but they'll offer things like umbilical cord cells or placental cells or amniotic fluid stem cells. And you know, who knows where they're getting it from? They're getting it from, you know, some hospital in South America that, you know, women are, you know, sort of donating their placental tissue or something like that, or, you know, donating voluntarily. You know, so it's very problematic. There's a lot of ethical issues behind this. And so the at least our government has really regulated it. But you can go to these stem cell labs all over the world, you know, and get like these proprietary stem cell products that are a combination of who knows what, right? Placental, umbilical, some nonsense that maybe altered and manipulated in the lab to increase the concentration of these cells and then inject it somewhere. So it's very dangerous. We don't know the efficacy. We don't know the risks. We don't really even know what's being injected half the time. And there's people that are really, it's in the news. It's probably not enough, but there's people that are having some real serious adverse events. So that's the other thing, just being mindful of where, you know, what kind of quote unquote regenerative medicine clinic you're going to. I mean, I always recommend people to go to a clinician that like has like myself that has like a general approach to things, that maybe has different tools in their tool belt, but not necessarily going to like just like an advertised stem cell clinic.
Yeah, that's frightening. I'd never thought of it in that context. I do remember when I had my kids, I donated the cord blood and stem cell. It went to like, I think, a legitimate place.
That's a real thing. And those cells can right now be used in blood cancers.
Yeah.
And maybe, I think, In our lifetime, I hope that we can utilize those cells for other. I hope it doesn't come up, but you know, I hope hopefully the indications are somewhat broader.
Yeah. But yeah, that's frightening. I hadn't actually thought that there were people like getting them from outside of the U.S. and injecting.
Oh, this
them.
Is rampant, right? I mean, this Great is people from and the islands, you know, Caribbean islands and in Europe and South America to get. Again, like we talked about, when you're vulnerable and you have a condition that's chronic and that, you know, traditional, you know, allopathic medicine, you know, like MD medicine has not helped, and you have the resources and you're ready to drop 5, 10, 20 grand on some intervention, hoping that it's going to work, and you're grasping for straws.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And I think both sides of the business model, like the patient is vulnerable and probably the donor, right? The donor probably needs the cash.
I wouldn't even call them like a willing donor, I bet. You know, I mean, who knows?
Ooh.
I can't imagine it's like an ethical setup.
No, I can't either. It's, okay, let's, for, I know we, many of us complain about the government, myself included, but there are times when these are things that like need to be regulated.
No,
you don't want them to get a bad name because they actually, I mean, even in blood cancers, right? They're life-saving.
No, there's a huge potential for them, for sure. Yeah. And you, it's not like we're not utilizing them, we're studying them. And so that's the other thing. I mean, yeah, you know, I don't specifically know of, you know, places like HSS, you know, Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, some of these bigger institutions, they're running trials left and right. And so, you know, your listeners could always go on PubMed and go online and look for FDA, NIH funded trials. All that's public information, and see if there's something that that might be of interest and you know, someone that could potentially enroll in a study. All the information's out there. You could always look at the PI, the principal investigator, and email them. And trust me, these researchers are always looking for a bigger N, right? Just people to recruit. And so I urge your listeners to see, you know, to look up who's doing these trials and potentially be part of them.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I'm a big PubMed fan. I'm always reading stuff. Okay, so final question before the final. Somebody walks into the office and you choose to do PRP or stem cell. What is the experience? Is it an injection? What is the typical experience?
Yeah, it's a procedure. So you know this is done usually in it depends, I guess, but like I typically do these in my office, you know, in like a pseudo sterile environment. We really try to, you know, the biggest complication is infection risk. And so we utilize a lot of sterile technique, but we are obtaining these cells, like I said, from adipose or bone marrow or just venous blood. So for platelets, we do a blood draw, just the way you would get like a blood test. We typically draw a large volume, 60 milliliters. So I don't know, I'm like, this is like a bottle of Diet Coke. It's like probably a third of a bottle, you know, and then you
send 5 ounces.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know why I can't convert that right now, but we, you know, 60 milliliters, and we have a centrifuge. So you have to, in order to get the platelets to be concentrated in plasma, you have to remove things that aren't plasma or platelets. So you take out the red blood cells. Then there's this, I mean, not to get into the weeds about this, but there's sort of a debate on, you know, the utility of leukocytes, like white blood cells, whether or not to keep them for certain conditions and to also spin them out for other conditions. But the point is, you use a centrifuge and you spin down the blood, and you take out the red blood cells and a lot of the white blood cells, and you end up with a concentrated solution of platelets in a small volume of plasma. And then that's your injectate. That's the solution that you're putting into a hip, knee, shoulder, whatever, SI joint. I typically utilize ultrasound when I'm administering these injections for proper visualization of the target structure and proper visualization of the structures you want to avoid. So yeah, I certainly encourage your listeners to, you know, when they're getting procedures done, to have them done by someone that's utilizing some sort of image guidance for them.
Sure.
To be honest, I haven't, you know, I've done both bone marrow and adipose derived interventions, but that's certainly extremely infrequent in my practice. And so, yeah, I mean, typically for an adipose derived, it's a sort of like a mini liposuction in the office. You use a volume of like anesthetic solution. You inject it into adipose tissue, typically like around the abdominal area, and you do essentially like a mini liposuction, aspirating a large volume of fat. And then you, you don't, I guess, process it is not the right term, but you have to like filter it out a bit. And this is sort of the same thing. You end up with a concentrate solution of stem cells, essentially MSCs, mesenchymal stromal cells, that then can be injected in whatever structure. And bone marrow is the same thing. You aspirate the marrow, that's typically obtained from like the pelvic bone. So you aspirate marrow, a certain volume of it, and sometimes that can be concentrated. I think there's a group of people that think that concentrating it or spinning it down actually reduces the number of stem cells versus just doing the aspiration without the concentration portion of it. But anyway, yeah, so you have to get it. The way someone would get a bone marrow biopsy, we would obtain from the marrow those cells.
Okay.
So it's not, you know, it's definitely the fat in the bone marrow, it's a little bit more invasive. And that probably adds a cost to you know, the stem cell interventions, which are much more expensive than platelets. But yeah, we're not sure for what conditions we would use one over the other.
Okay. Very interesting. So it's not just your average cortisone shot.
No.
Which for some of us is enough.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's my go-to for someone with AS, you know. Yeah. And it's effective, and it really is effective. But and certainly there's a downside. You can't do that too frequently due to the systemic side effects. And so I'm hoping that there's some sort of clarity on the use of these other cell-based treatments for some of the chronic issues that, you know, patients with AS deal with.
Yeah, we appreciate you, believe me. Keep going. Okay. So I think other than, did I miss anything? And anything that you have hope about that you didn't get to share with us?
I think that the world of like spine care, whether it's in the context of AS or, you know, just more, like wear and tear, age-related spondylosis, not necessarily spondylitis. I think that these regenerative therapies are going to play a big role in helping mitigate symptoms and improving function. I think there's a lot of promising work being done in this field. I think even folks with AS who, you know, are ankylosed or sort of, you know, kind of, in a stage where their spine mobility is really impaired, there's nothing that we have that can like reverse that or change that. But I think when you have surrounding soft tissue that's responding to the underlying bony ankylosis in a way that's causing pain and dysfunction, I'm hopeful that some of these interventions can help at least mitigate some of those symptoms from the surrounding structures, right? Like the ligaments and the muscles that support the spine.
Amazing.
That can be part of the pain generating source.
Amazing. Well, Dr. Am I mispronouncing it? Baxi or Boxy?
Baxi's right. Baxi. My parents would say Bakshi, but I say Baxi, so it's all the same.
Okay, perfect. Dr. Baxi, thank you so very much for your time. And we look forward to hearing more about regenerative therapies because I think there's a big appetite for them. So thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Hope this was helpful.
SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie.
Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.